Welcome to our weekly slow ride through sports and pop culture. It's the Bobcast, a weekly tour of sports and pop culture. We don't throw most pieces around here, no conspiracy theories around here, and especially no kicks to the groin on this show. Follow us at the Bobcast Show on Twitter. I'm your host and tour guide, Bobby Manning. And we have a fantastic show for you this Friday afternoon, Friday night probably by the time you hear this. And we'll be with you for the next 30, 35 minutes or so. And against all odds, we're talking NBA Finals today. When we went into the series, saw some of the early things that happened, I thought it'd be five games, maybe six games at the most, but we have a game seven ahead Sunday night in the Oracle Arena. Cleveland Cavaliers, Golden State Warriors. And instead of NBA draft, offseason, and more, we're talking Steph Curry and the Warriors folding, but headed home where they're 50-4 this year. Andre Iguodala's got a bad back. Andrew Bogut is down and out with some bone bruises, and Mr. LeBron James has brought us to this point with one of the most dominant finals performances you'll ever see. He leads the entire series in points, assists, steals, and blocks, and he's tied for the lead in rebounds. Just an all-time performance from James. Kyrie Irving's emerged, a guy who I've had some issues with in the past, but I got to give him all the credit in the world for the performance he's put on. Tristan Thompson is rising to new levels, and Kevin Love is sinking to rock bottom or below, whichever you prefer. Steph Curry struggled, but he broke the three-point record to this point in the NBA Finals, and that's how weird of a series it's been. One of the weirdest finals you'll ever see. Especially with the way the Warriors completely lost their composure. And we'll hit on all of that with our guest, Snotty Drippin, today. One of the best basketball personalities out there. One of the earliest people to follow me and give my career a little boost with some of the support he's given me. So here he is, the true king of basketball Twitter, James Snotty Drippin, as he's known across basketball Twitter of San Diego, has 19,000 followers and counting. He drives incredible conversations on the site, interacting with fans who he sometimes has to hit with that block button, giving his own takes and game commentary while routinely rashing on any poor tweeter who he has to unleash his fury on. Perhaps best known for his brush up with an angry Kobe Bryant fan who was ready to go to blows over their argument, Snotty started the viral sensation Meet Me in Temecula. I'm not sure if there's t-shirts, but there should be. I know I'd buy one. As his adversary drove over an hour to the California city to throw down, only to learn Snotty was in Arizona and just unleashed the entire internet on him. Even Kobe Bryant himself heard the incident, and it only added to the legend of Snotty. His writing can be found at bballbreakdown.com, where he's an NBA columnist, and you can find him on Twitter at Snotty Drippin. We now bring you the man himself, James Snotty Drippin. Welcome aboard the tour, Snotty.
Hey, what's up, man? Thanks for having me on board. A couple real quick things. Come on, man. Legend. That's really humbling. I appreciate it. I prefer icon or maybe you know, godlike figure, if you could. So not legend. We'll roll with that.
I gotta ask you right off the bat, Snotty. When did you fall in love with the game of basketball? I'll say when I did first. 2008 Finals, 8 years to this day. Just a young boy watching his favorite team win the championship. It was a feeling like no other. Game six, watching Paul Pierce, Ray Allen, Kevin Garnett, and all those guys pummel the Lakers. One of the best basketball moments of my life, and that's what really spurred my love of the game. When did it all start for you?
Oh, man, my first images of basketball are, I'm an old head, man. I'm an old school fan with a kind of a new school mentality because I mean, I came up in the days of Barkley, MJ, Clyde Drexler. So, I mean, I remember when MJ first broke through. And the big hype was Magic versus MJ in the finals. Just seeing Michael Jordan always find the next year was amazing to me. So that was probably when I really first latched on and fell in love, man, and where I was just, like, you know, fanatical about it. I knew almost every player on every team. I was known to, and then, you know, I got older and got a better appreciation for it when, as a youngster, I swapped teams because my first intro to the NBA was Michael Jordan. So I was all about the Bulls. And when he retired that second time, I didn't know what to do because that team was horrid. And, you know, I had no ties to the city. I latched on the Celtics, so I went through a lot of pain with the Celtics. And, yeah, so, my first memory, of course, is with Michael, man. Michael doing the, you know, the shrug after the three against the Blazers. He was on another level.
It's a memory I wish I had myself. And I know a guy I always point to and wish I could have seen play was Larry Bird. I mean, I was born in 1998 myself, so I missed some of those prime years with the Bulls. But, you know, the Celtics weren't great for most of my early life, but one of my first memories was that championship, and it was just an incredible feeling watching. 8 years since that day, it's just unbelievable how long it's been. It doesn't feel that long. It feels like it was yesterday for me, honestly. So I want to talk to you about the Celtics. You're a fellow Celtics fan. How did that start for you?
Like I said, that Bulls team broke up, and I was a young kid, you know, a young man actually looking for a team. And I liked Paul Pierce, I liked Antoine, I liked, I just liked what they were about. I watched Larry as a kid. I watched the younger Celtics. I saw the pain when Reggie Lewis and Len Bias, the tragedies happened there. So I stuck with them, and you know, I was an NBA fan in general, but I followed them. Through the ugly years, I loved Paul Pierce. I thought his name deserved to be up there with the Tracy McGrady's and prime Kobe's and everything. He was amazing. The team just wasn't very good. And Antoine Walker was so much fun. But looking back now, he was a pretty bad player. So I just latched onto the Celtics. And then it's funny because even then, Kevin Garnett, you know, was my favorite player, even though he wasn't on my favorite team. And then I heard they're getting Kevin Garnett, and I was just over the, you know, I was over, I lost my mind. And then they won that championship.
Anything is possible.
Yeah, man. Which, if you look back, is a terrible, you know, we all know now it's a silly marketing thing he was doing. But that team was just so organically great, you know, once they brought him in. And they loved each other, and they worked hard, and they played together. It was an amazing team to watch.
So we'll pivot to basketball Twitter. You joined the site in 2009. You've grown to 19,000 followers in the years since then. What brought you to Twitter, and what inspired your now infamous name, Snotty Drippin?
So even back when I was watching MJ and them, my favorite, you know, the guy who always caught my eye and I pulled for was Scottie Pippen. Because we know Michael was the man, but Scottie did so much on the courts, man. And, like, he was that glue that held that team together. Mike was the engine, but he was, like, the, I don't know, the transmission. And so it's funny, I remember I was on ESPN, they do this, the Daily Dynamite, it was a chat they used to do. And this guy, like, you know, luminary that we all know, like Zach Harper. A lot of the bloggers now who are big time, you know, they started there, and it was just moderating. And I just, you know, Scottie Pippen was my guy, so I started the name Snotty Drippin. And I remember at the end of all the, you know, the Daily Dime Live chats, you know, everybody would talk about, you know, hey, well, follow me on Twitter. I made a Twitter account, and, you know, I floated around with a few hundred followers for a couple of years. And I guess my followers really took off. I made my own blog for a little while, and then the whole Temecula thing really launched me into another stratosphere.
We'll get to that in a little bit. But I want to talk a little bit more about basketball Twitter. What do you think makes it so great? I mean, it's almost grown into this, you know, mythical type thing where every time something happens, we're going to get a Jordan face or someone saying something dumb, the hot takes, all of it. It's just incredible to follow, especially on the game nights like last night. What do you think has elevated basketball Twitter to the status it's reached?
It's funny. I think that what makes quote unquote basketball Twitter great is that it's an amalgamation of all the different aspects of Twitter. I mean, it's real time. You can put your own thoughts. You can add on other people's thoughts. You can tear apart someone else's thoughts. It's funny to watch the ebb and flow of the, I don't want to say groupthink because I mean there's a lot of dissenting opinions there, but overall, you know, we know who's great. We know who's it's pretty intelligent bunch there overall. There's always gonna be some fools or some people who are just misguided. But so yeah, it's just almost like a feeling of camaraderie. Even the people that don't like you and you might not really be fans of, you're all just, you know, the common cause. We all love the NBA.
This was a SB Nation headline, December 26, 2014. Seth Rosenthal, guy drives to Temecula to fight someone over a Kobe Bryant Twitter argument on Christmas. How the hell did you end up on SB Nation, Snotty?
I have no clue, man. I remember I saw the team stream for Bleacher Report, and I saw my face on there. I tweeted, WTF. Yeah, man. I mean, I was with my family, my mom, and, you know, while I was watching, you know, they let me, you know, Saturday games were on, and my family was just cooking and eating, and, you know, silly Twitter argument, and somebody was calling Kobe, you know, oh, he's still elite, and he was averaging, like, you know, 20 points a game, scoring, you know, shooting 33% away from the floor. He hadn't been good that season. He was one of the injuries, coming back from injury, and I just laughed about it, you know. I kind of, you know, I was being really derisive because it's silly. He, you know, Kobe's time was done back in 2012. The last time he was at an elite level. And, you know, the guy didn't react very well and started making threats. And, hey, well, how about, you know, you're in San Diego. Meet me here in Temecula. You know, I was in San Diego. I'm not driving to Temecula. That's stupid. So, I mean, I just threw out a sure. You know, come on, loser, let's go. And, you know, then it's funny because, I put my phone down, I'm eating with my mom, and then we're in Arizona. And like, I see all these, you know, all these, my mentions are just going nuts. And you know, I see a picture, he's driving, and I go, oh, this guy's this serious? And, it went from there. It just kind of took a life of its own, man.
It was incredible, and it made national headlines. And they say Kobe Bryant himself even heard about it. What was your reaction to hearing that the man himself heard about this story?
Well, I mean, cornballs of a feather flock together. So, I mean, I wasn't surprised when Kobe was, like, proud to hear that. You know, it's funny, like, just that level of insecurity that floats through him and his fans, just remarkable for a guy of his stature that he was also so just, I don't know. Whatever, I'm glad he retired. I'm glad he's gone.
Good riddance.
Oh, yeah, I've been ready for him to be gone since 2012. I can respect his legacy as a player and what he's done, but the people that his rabid fanatics behind him that, literally, it's almost impossible to overrate an all-time great, but they've done it. And, you know, his myth is larger than his actual impact, and it's kind of annoying. So I'm glad he's done.
So across your Twitter line, how much dumb stuff do you run across online every day, whether it's people just blowing up your mentions with hot takes or just people getting on your nerves? And with that, what's a rough estimate of how many people you've had to block on the site over the years?
Oh, man, I couldn't even give you an estimate. It's in the thousands, I know. But my thing is, I block somebody, but I don't like the shirt they're wearing when they mention me. I block somebody just for, you know, for a misspelling, just because I feel like it. To me, it is what it is. I want my timeline to look like I want it to look. So, I don't think I see any more or any less than anybody else. I think I'm actually on a hashtag be polite challenge where I'm going to stop, sometimes I can probably be a little irascible when people say things I don't like or I think they're just being ridiculous. But, hey, everyone wasn't born with the same amount of brain cells as me, as everyone else. So I'm trying to be a little more tolerant and understanding, and it's going pretty well.
What's the first step to becoming a more kind and understanding Snotty?
Just mute the short, like, instead of even responding to a lot of the dumb stuff I see, just go ahead, just mute that person. So I'm not even enticed into trying to explain anything to them, like, you know. So, yeah, just hit the mute button and just get them off my timeline.
Ignorance is bliss, I guess. So we'll pivot now to the NBA Finals, which blows my mind that we have to talk about it, but we got a Game 7 coming up here, and now that it's ahead, I got to ask you, who has more on the line now, the MVP Steph Curry or the former MVP LeBron James, who all the cameras are on those two guys right now?
The answer to this question seems really simple to me, but it's a very fluid answer because for LeBron James, for better or for worse, the goalpost is always moving. He came into this finals, and I'm pretty sure that the overall consensus was somewhere around Golden State in five or six games. And for the first two games especially, we all thought that it was, you know, hey, if Golden State gives them a game, you know, because they slack up, that's cool. But this was my stance. I'll speak for myself. After the first two games, I said, well, Steph Curry hasn't played well. Klay hasn't played well. Yet they've beaten the Cavs pretty handily. The only way Golden State loses the game is if they get lazy. And, you know, it looks really bad for Cleveland.
It's amazing.
Here we are, I've never seen anything like this before. Now we're tied 3-3 going to game 7 Golden State. All momentum is on Cleveland's side. LeBron James, I think, is probably more confident than he's ever been, you know, in his illustrious career. Kyrie Irving is on another level. His confidence is you know, you could tell the way he's out there. He doesn't think anybody can guard him, and he's absolutely correct right now. For Golden State, Iguodala's hurt. Bogut's hurt. Klay Thompson and Steph are taking all the shots they want now, and it doesn't seem to make a difference, and it's just been a crazy series. So I think right now the pressure is squarely on Golden State. However, if Golden State wins it at home, as they should, we're going to hear LeBron James unfairly get his legacy tarnished, and they're going to just throw out the record in the finals, and he didn't call it the league moment. They're going to ignore his two back-to-back 41-point games. So that's not fair. So I think overall right now Steph Curry should be under the gun a little heavier, but I think in the scheme of things, LeBron James, who's already one of the all-time greats, and the question is finally going to be where does he end up? For better or worse, fair or not, how this final ends is going to really be a mark of his legacy.
Legacy-wise, between two teams, you got the 73-win Warriors on one side, and LeBron going for what will likely be the biggest finals comeback ever if he pulls it off. I mean, 32 teams have gone down 1-3 in the finals. Those teams are 0-32 to this point. Only two, the 51 Knicks and 66 Lakers, we've been able to push it to seven games. So they've already done something that's only been done twice in NBA history, and I think you got to give them credit for that. But like you said, it's all about sealing the deal, and that Game 7 is going to have big legacy consequences on both sides. 18 straight MVPs have won Game 7s. Well, I don't think that matters as much here because you pretty much have an MVP in his own right coming at him in LeBron James. So this is just two ballers going head-to-head, and I think whoever, you know, gets the better of the other side in that game is going to come out on top. So I got to ask you, too, it will be the biggest comeback in NBA Finals history if he can pull it off, but will it elevate LeBron James to a, you know, we hate to make the comparison, but to a Michael Jordan status if he can bring that ring to Cleveland that's never been there before and do it in this fashion?
All right, well, all due respect to whatever LeBron's going to end up, whatever he's going to do, there will never be another Michael Jordan. And not just for what he did on the court and, you know, the six titles and six tries and, you know, 6 and 8 years. That's all. Hey, that was all just a matter of circumstance. The fact is, social media and the instant access and the 24-hour news cycle that we have with players, we'll never view players the way we viewed them back then. Back then, they were mythological almost. Yeah, you saw them on TV and you saw them, you know, quick shots. If you met them walking on the walk out somewhere, you knew that was a player. But we have unprecedented access to players, and we just view them in a different way. Back then, there was actually like a Mount Olympus for these players. They've come down, play the game, and go back to Mount Olympus. Now we know that they're just like us, because we see them doing things like us, you know, that people record on their cell phones and tweet. And so it's a different ball game. Yes. Winning it in this fashion will, I think, dispel a lot of the issues people have with LeBron James. Because let's be real, the word hater is overused, but there are people who just hate LeBron James. No matter what he does, they'll find a way to downgrade it or to pick it apart. So there will be some people who say the silly stuff about, oh, he's not clutch, and he folds, and he's, you know, they're questioning his heart, questioning his manhood. It's unfair, but they're doing it. But this will, I mean, if he pulls this off, and especially the way he's been playing, like, let's look at this here. Since they were down 0-2, LeBron James is averaging 35 points a game, 12 rebounds a game, 8 assists, 2.5 steals, and 3 blocks. He's shooting like 56% from the floor. That's just... as good as he was last year in the finals and losing effort, this is phenomenal. You know, so if he pulls this off and has a game around the last four games, it's I've already had LeBron James as a talent in my top five. I think this will put him up there in a lot of people's top five or top ten if he pulls this off.
And I think what's most astonishing about it, too, is in this era of perimeter play and three-point shooting and all that, he's basically dominated the series without a three-point shot in his arsenal at all. I mean, he's hit a few threes there and there, but this is all penetration, smart plays, just physical dominance. I mean, no one out there can handle him. Andre Iguodala has tried his best up until the injury struck, which is a big factor too. Andrew Bogut going down made a difference, but he's on another gear right now, and it's just amazing to watch. And between the clutch performances we've seen from him with his back against the wall in elimination games, and on the GM side of it where he's been criticized, especially a year ago with how they handled the Tristan Thompson offseason, they give him $14 million after originally pushing for the max, and they end up giving Kevin Love the max. But you see in this series, Tristan Thompson's coming up bigger than ever before. He just had an incredible game, one of the best games you'll ever see from a role player. 15 points, 16 rebounds, plus 32. It was incredible to watch. And Kevin Love, two quick fouls, and he's basically out for the game. What's going on in that front court in Cleveland?
Well, you know what's going on is that one of my guys will be on breakdown. I think Adam Spinell wrote a really good piece on Kevin Love and how he's trapped between eras. And it's weird because the NBA evolution has almost been like the arms race, or let's say the technological boom, because it took up until the 1900s, things slowly progressed. But then we had flight in the early 1900s, and then, like, you know, 50 years later, we're having space travel. And now we're up to the point where, you know, technology is just, you know, every year there's so many developments. Well, for years, the power forward position wasn't that different. And then Kevin Love came along right in the era when, you know, hey, he was one of the first and seemed like one of the best, you know, stretch power forwards. He was, you know, 26 to 15 in Minnesota for a losing team, but hey, it looked great. Well, we were already to the stage where it seemed like evolution might have passed him by, because while he can stretch the floor, as we see, you know, if his pick and roll defense is as bad as it is, and he's not very versatile, because now versatility is the name of the game. And we're to the point where, hey, his first game of this series, he put up 17 and 13 rebounds. And since then, he's had, like, I think a total of about 32 points and, like, 18 rebounds in the next, you know, five games. And, I mean, he had a 34-point game against Atlanta this season, and he's had 32 points in the last five games of the series. He had a 19-rebound game against Indiana this season. He's had 18 rebounds for the rest of the series, you know, from games 2 through 6. So it's... The main thing is he just doesn't move his feet. And while Chris Bosh was able to adapt, you know, and be water and fill in the cracks they needed him to fill in Miami, Kevin Love can't do that. Kevin Love can only do what he wants, what he does, which is, you know, smash the rebounds, be a volume scorer from the perimeter, and, you know, doing throw weight around inside, he can get you some buckets. And if he's not allowed to do that, which, you know, LeBron James has to penetrate, get inside, Kyrie needs to handle the ball, you limit Kevin Love's touches, and all of a sudden he's very ineffective.
He's no Chris Bosh. I think that's a foregone conclusion between watching the two teams LeBron's had to play with now and their quote-unquote big threes. But, you know, he's talented. Even the first game of the series we saw, he was 17 points, 13 rebounds. And you can't help but notice, especially with the body language, I just don't think he belongs there in Cleveland. I mean, you saw with LeBron James, he was out there pressing the media hard to get Tristan Thompson his extension. And, you know, he came out publicly and said they wanted Kevin Love back, but there just didn't seem to be that same enthusiasm about it. Do you think this is just a fit issue more than a basketball issue, or are they about equal?
I spent a lot of time in the last few months as we talked about Kevin Love on and off. I've been trying to think, what team would give up prime assets and be willing to pay Kevin Love and gets markedly better because he's there? And outside of, like, the worst lottery teams who just need talent, I can't think of a team that, you know, that's a really good team that needs what Kevin Love brings. Let's think about this. They brought in Shannon Frye and were able to sit Kevin Love. And Shannon Frye did a lot of the same things Kevin Love does, stretch the floor. He even gave a little bit of rim protection, even though he's no shot blocker, but he's 7 foot. And in the early rounds of the playoffs, you could have took Kevin Love out of the rotation, and Shannon Frye would have done the exact same thing. So it's like he's on the way to becoming, you know, he's the premier player getting paid max money, but the skills that he brings is almost something you need from a role player. And it's really tough because, obviously, hey, the guy put up 26 and 15 a couple years ago. He can do certain things, but what he does, it's hard to say, we're going to feature you in our offense and keep you on the floor because he defends so poorly.
Yeah, and a play that sticks out to me, I can't remember the exact game it was years back or a year ago, but there was a pick-and-roll situation where guys were shifting, switching, and he just aimlessly ran the half court. And I think it might have been against the Warriors, and Draymond Green just had an easy cut to the basket as he just looked like he was in a he was playing a different game from everyone else. The defense is astonishingly bad, and I think that's something you can't ignore, where defense is at such a premium in today's league with all the switches and the complexity of the offenses. But we'll see. I think it's a foregone conclusion he's out of Cleveland, but like you said, it's a lot of money to take on, and giving up assets for a guy like that is risky business. So we'll move on to the rest of the finals right now. It's just incredible how the series has shifted. And like I said in the beginning, it's one of the weirdest series I've ever watched in my life. In the first four games, you had Draymond Green flustering LeBron. Irving was basically non-existent in those first two games. But now we're seeing Curry throwing mouth pieces into the crowd and his wife tweeting about the league being rigged. And that Steve Kerr press conference last night, from the top down, that team just looks flustered. And the Cavaliers almost look like the team confidence-wise that's coming off a championship. How is this series flipped upside down almost overnight, it seems like?
As much blame can be shifted onto Steph Curry and Klay Thompson, because those two have been the engine all season. Let's take a look at their first three games. First three games, Klay was only taking, first three games, Klay was only taking 13 shots a game. He was shooting 37%, and guess what? Golden State was up 2-1. First three games, Curry was only averaging 16 points a game. He was only taking 13 shots a game. They were up 2-1. Last three games, both of those guys were over 20 shots a game. Last three games, which now they've lost two of those games. Curry is averaging 31 points a game. He's taking 22 shots tonight, 13 threes. Klay, 29 points a game, taking 18 shots a game and 10 threes. And their numbers look great. One day averaging 29, other day averaging 31. And all of a sudden, though, the rest of their guys are out of rhythm. And it's crazy because if this was Russell Westbrook, who went from 13 shots a game to 22 shots a game while his team all of a sudden coughed up two losses to a team they're supposed to be superior to, he's getting killed for hero ball. If this is Kevin Durant, who all of a sudden went from 14 shots a game and wins, and he's shooting 22 times a game and they're losing, he's getting killed. But nary a peep is being said about how Steph Curry and Klay Thompson have suddenly hijacked the offense, which I guess what you want your star players to do in most cases. But not a word is being said. Now, Dre missed the game. That killed him. I think that gave that loss with Dre out gave Cleveland another level of confidence. Boga being out, even though he plays sparing minutes, but he opens up and sets the tone, protecting the rim. That changes everything. I think Kerr is very kind of rigid with his rotations, and even though he's open to the thing, but Aziz is in the doghouse for some reason. And starting off the death lineup didn't seem to seem to backfire in Kerr's face. So it's all about confidence, and LeBron James has utmost confidence in himself, while I think Kerr and company seem to have their confidence is a little bit shaken.
When I look at what's going on in this series personally, I look at the Warriors and how they've just been shaking off that game. I mean, in the regular season, they were coming out and basically walking through those games, just playing their style of basketball and dominating teams with it. But when I look at how the series has changed from those first three games to the last three games, I can't help but look at how the Cavaliers have utilized Kyrie Irving. And Kyrie Irving's a guy I've ripped in the past. Not a good defender. Off the ball, he's almost useless. But when you put this guy on the ball, there doesn't seem to be a matchup that he can't win. I mean, I've seen Iguodala on him, a great defender, just get crossed up to the heavens. Klay Thompson, they've tried him a lot on him. He's gotten the best of him in some possessions, but once you start putting the picks and stuff in there, he starts to get off it a little bit. And those handles just rip a defense apart. They have you backpedaling towards the basket, and he can just pull up while you're falling on your ass almost and nail a shot in your face. The mismatch Kyrie Irving creates on the ball, I think, are just so devastating to a defense that they've torn this series apart.
I agree with that, because LeBron can play as great as he wants to, as we saw last finals. But without a supporting player behind him, it doesn't matter. And, again, since being down 0-2, Kyrie's putting up 32, 4, and 5 with two steals tonight. I mean, that means between him and LeBron, 67 points tonight. That's incredible. And to the point that Kevin Love, as bad as he's played, it doesn't even matter. And it shows, again, I wonder if we reached that tipping point, because, sure, Golden State is a three-point shooting team. That's what they base it off of, and their suffocating defense backs it up. But when two individual players are playing so well that no matter what your individual defenders do, they can't stop them, it seems to throw Golden State completely out of whack. So Kyrie Irving right now is just as important as LeBron. Sure, LeBron is doing everything, but Kyrie, as secondary scorer, has just really put a knife into Golden State, and I don't know how they're going to stop him.
And you need a glue guy pulling it all together, and you got to give Tristan Thompson all the credit in the world for the job he's done at both ends. The cuts to the basket have been incredible. The pick-and-roll defense is what astonishes me the most. He's incredible just getting between there and picking up guys, and just his instincts defensively are good. He may not have the best defensive tools, but he knows how to play in that system, and unlike Kevin Love, he doesn't get caught running the half court on switches and all these different things that the Warriors throw at you offensively, so you got to give him credit too. We'll move on from the basketball talk for right now, but off the court, Brian Windhorst already took the time to roast her last night, but I got to give you the opportunity because this is your specialty. What do you have to say to Ayesha Curry, who of course came out last night and said that the NBA is rigged and then quickly deleted the tweet?
I think Ayesha Curry right now is she's a microcosm of what Golden State Twitter is going through and what Golden State in general is going through, because last year she was the poster girl for this perfect wife with her perfect husband, Steph Curry. I've been saying this all year at 20, because this says more about, I think, society than Golden State or Ayesha Curry or Steph Curry, because she's human. And in a moment of peak, she said something she probably shouldn't have said. Well, we know she shouldn't have said, you know, Your husband's the MVP and you're complaining about the league he plays in being rigged. That's not what you do. That's horrible optics. It's horrible on her part. Very immature, and it's true, but she's a human being and she's not a player. So, I mean, I can kind of understand in the moment of anger. But it's funny because, yes, last year we all embraced, and when I say we, I was never a fan of this whole thing because it seems almost creepy, the celebrity worship we have. But Ayesha Curry was embraced and she was loved, and everything she said, you know, they were holding her up as this paragon of almost perfection. And we watched that flip now, and she took shots at LeBron with his the whole foul thing with Draymond, which I thought was a little, you know, she just keep your mouth shut. But I'm not the one to say that. That's fine. But now, yes, it shows that when things get tough, you get a little glimpse of humanity from people, and it's not always what you really want to see. And so for her, I mean, this is my be polite challenge. She's wrong. That may not rigged. It just shows, it's almost like she's part of basketball Twitter, because when things don't go the way a lot of people want, they want to say, oh, the world's conspiring against me, you know? And it's funny to hear her say that from the seat of privilege that she's in. She's the wife of a millionaire and a superstar basketball player. And you tell me to lose a game, sure, there wasn't bad foul quality and stuff last night. But, I mean, the last couple of them, just run down the court, play defense, bro. Stop sneaking around trying to get steals. You know, it's bad calls. It's part of the game. So I'm not going to roast her. I'm going to take the high road, like she said that, you know, that whole LeBron joke did. I'm taking the high road. I'm not going to roast her. But I like the heel turn. I like the fact that Golden State has been elevated to the point where they were adored. And now we're starting to see it. The Draymond, you know, the crotch kicking and punching. Steph's a little off his pivot right now. So this is fascinating, I think.
Yeah, the perfection around Golden State is taking a big hit this series. I think that's a great point by you. And we're seeing Snotty transform right before our eyes, I guess. No roast from Snotty Drippin here on the air of Ayesha Curry. Of course, Windhorst took another route last night. I thought what he said was hilarious. If the NBA's rigged, it's benefited Curry and his wife with millions of dollars and two MVPs, which isn't a bad deal if it is indeed rigged. And I thought, I'm not going to take credit for this myself, but I saw another great tweet out there. The New York Knicks stink, the LA Lakers stink, and San Antonio Spurs have a dynasty. If the NBA is rigging it that way, they really screwed up. So we'll move on from that talk. I'll have a little more on that later. But
I think my man, V Goodwill over, I think, the Chicago guy. I saw that, or Detroit guy. That was pretty good. I saw that too. But, yeah, let's go ahead.
Yeah, we'll give him credit for that, I guess. We can double-check that later at the Bobcast show. We'll retweet that. The Jordan face. Some more great ones last night. I saw the one you retweeted, Anderson Varejao, with the hair covered in Jordan faces. It's unbelievable. This meme is just unbelievable. It's the meme that will not die. It's the greatest meme of all time. And every single game, you know there's going to be a situation that just calls for a Jordan face. I got to ask you, what's the first Jordan face you ever saw, and what do you think makes this meme so great?
Well, let's all bow down to the crying Jordan meme. We are all crying Jordan. It's hilarious. I see people say something like, "Oh, it's not even funny. I don't get it. Why do people like it so much? It's not funny." And that, I just want to take a Jordan cry face and put it on that person's avatar for the picture. I think it's just, it's funny though, because that was Mike crying at his Hall of Fame induction. So it's not even like a bad thing, but it just encapsulates it. Just, and that's the thing about a meme. A meme doesn't have to make sense. Once it's in place, it's in place, and nothing you can say about it. It's just the epitome of everything that when you expect things to go right and they go left, it's just without saying a word, just put a Jordan cry face on it and we're right there. And you can put it in somebody, like somebody did Anderson Varejao's hair last night, like you said. That's just, it's to the point now where no matter what, if it's even really needed or not, it just makes anything a little bit better. So it's one of the memes. Usually a meme is around for a couple of days, a week, and then it becomes old. Usually Facebook gets hold of it, and then nobody wants to talk about it anymore because Facebook ruins it. But I don't care. That one's never going to die. I think we're going to be putting Jordan – one day the Jordan cry face meme is going to be on the dollar bill.
I'm sure it has been already. But
on the real dollar bill, we're going to be passing currency around with the Jordan meme on it because it's going to be like the national treasure.
It really is a national treasure. I remember the first time I saw it was the Mets losing the World Series last year, the Royals, and the big apple they have in center field and City Field in New York. They just, a giant Jordan face rising above there. They shoot it up every time there's a home run there in New York, and the red apple instantly Jordan face when the Mets lose. Nice. The other week I saw a great one. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump had their feud on Twitter going, and all of a sudden you see a map of the United States and just the Jordan face pixelated across the whole thing when your two presidential candidates are fighting on Twitter. Every time you think you've exhausted all the uses for it, you just find another one, and it makes you laugh out loud every time. It's unbelievable. And like you said, maybe we'll see it on the dollar bill one day.
Two of my favorites was when
George Washington.
When the Hornets lost in the playoffs this year, somebody put a Jordan cry face on Michael Jordan's real face, and that was ridiculous. And then when Curry dug up his shoes like last week, and we're all making fun of his new Curry Chef, Chef Curry 2s or whatever, somebody actually just superimposed the Jordan face on both the shoes, and that lets you know, man, it's multi-purpose. It's a multi-tool.
We're having a lot of fun this Friday afternoon, June 17th, with Snotty Drip in here, the king of the idol, everyone's idol on basketball Twitter, as he prefers to be called. We'll let you go in just a minute here, Snotty, but I'm going to put you on the spot first. You're going to hear it here first before anywhere else. What's the best Game 7 you've ever watched in your life, and who wins Sunday between the Cavaliers and the Warriors?
I can't call it the best Game 7. I'm really on the spot. And I would be here all day while I hem and haw about it. So I'm not gonna waste everybody's time. I know, hey, that Western Conference we just saw with OKC and Golden State, I was thinking to myself, I think for the first three games of this series, I was a little disappointed. I was like, all right, well, we've already seen the finals, but this is now living up to the hype. And you asked me this question a week ago, and I'd have laughed at you saying there will be no Game 7. Golden State winning this in 5 or 6 easily. Right now, all the momentum is in Cleveland's back pocket. LeBron James is healthy. He's not tired, and he has his full game is at his fingertips right now. He's drawing on past experiences, and he might not be quite as athletic as he was 4 years ago, but he's smarter, and he's showing it. Kyrie Irving right now is a weapon that LeBron can use, and I say that because LeBron puts him in positions and draws him attention and gets him good shots. Tristan Thompson is not scared of Draymond Green or anybody else, and he doesn't have to worry about Andrew Bogut. And unless Steph Curry can dig deep and find some of that magic he had from the regular season, which we haven't really seen during this postseason from him, I'm going to give it to Cleveland going away because LeBron James is just on another level, and Steph Curry has to try to find a way to match or exceed that level. And he hasn't shown to be able to do it so far this final. So right now, I mean, I'm not a big fan of either one of these teams, but LeBron James right now is – he can see the finish line, and I don't know if anyone's going to stop him. Mike Miller said it himself. Mike Miller is a good friend of LeBron. He said that, you know, I'm not going to lose face. And right now LeBron James is in that zone, in that mode. So I'm going to say Cleveland's going to win game seven.
I'm gonna take the other side of this one, and for no other reason than it would just be the most Cleveland thing ever to be down 1-3, get these performances out of LeBron James, bring it all the way back to a game seven, and then take a big fat L in Oracle. I just think that would add to the legacy of Cleveland sports so perfectly. And like you said, it's going to be tough for the Warriors to pull it off. They're on their home court, which helps a lot. Iguodala, I just have no clue how he's going to look Sunday. It's 2 days off, but those bad backs, they don't just go away over the night. So that's going to be affecting him. But if Steph Curry's the all-time player, if he's on this pedestal we've put him on over the past 2 years, I think he's going to be able to come out and just grab that trophy himself with clutch shooting, great playmaking. He's been off his game for a few games so far, but he still has broken the three-point record in this series. The Warriors are the kind of team that just when you count them out, they come back and just blow it up in your face and disprove everything you've ever seen, anything you've ever said about them for the past 2 games. So I'm going to go with the Warriors. I like them being an Oracle. You know, the Cavaliers haven't gotten a lot of shooting outside of Irving and LeBron himself on the floor. I think a whole team effort from the Warriors is going to get this done.
One thing I want to say before I go, man, I appreciate you having me on, is that I might have messed up because I almost kind of forgot J.R. Smith is on the Cavs. And one of my life lessons I want to tell people is if you're ever depending on J.R. Smith in a big moment, you've already lost. So that's going in your favor as far as that. But, yeah, this will be a great game seven, man. This is one, like I said, the biggest game in Cleveland franchise history, and obviously I think this might be one of the bigger games in, you know, Warriors history. So it's going to be interesting.
Yeah, no messing around with that. It is the biggest game in Cavaliers history. But we've enjoyed the time we've spent with you here on this weekly tour of sports and pop culture. And hopefully you'll join us again one day. Snotty Drippin, at Snotty Drippin on Twitter. Thanks for hopping aboard today.
Hey, thank you, brother. You got to check us out on B-Ball Breakdown, man. Hey, I'd love to come on again. Thanks, bro.
BballBreakdown.com. That's where you can find Snotty's writing. We thank him for being aboard today, just an incredible basketball personality. You can follow along with him on Twitter, Game 7 Sunday. So we'll move on to the other big topics going on in sports. NBA rigged. It's something that comes up every once in a while when there's situations like this. A 3-1 series suddenly flips to a 3-3 series, and we have a Game 7 out in Golden State. Now, this was already raised after the Draymond Green suspension, and Ayesha Curry, of course, brought it up last night via Twitter. And Jason Concepcion, even before she tweeted that out on The Ringer, Bill Simmons' new sports and pop culture platform. Hopefully we can get him on here one day. That would be a dream. But Concepcion says, I don't really think the NBA is rigged, but I will gleefully entertain each and every NBA conspiracy theory. The league is just more interesting, and there's a suggestion of disrepute and random assortments of notable people are getting hashtag mad online. NBA conspiracy theories are wondrous and bizarre. I like wrestling crossed with high-tech carnival. I'd rather live in a world where smart, slightly nefarious people work behind the curtain than I would a real one where chaos reigns, humanity is fallible, and players kick each other in the nuts multiple times only by accident. The shadow history is integral to the way the league is perceived. It provides a counterbalance to the official narratives, press releases, and commemorative videos. It's only there that we can learn about, in no particular order, Nick Bavetta, Game 6, 2002, Game 6, 2006, Wilt's moon landing-esque 100-point game, the frozen envelope, Michael Jordan's rumored crippling gambling addiction and league-mandated exile, the 2011, 12, 13, 14, and 16 draft lotteries, LeBron being a snitch, and the entire subgenre of using online jersey sales as auguries. Now, Concepcion brings on a great point. I think the conspiracy theories are a big part of what's raised the NBA to this mystical level as a league, especially in some of the big playoff moments we've had throughout the years. But the conversation is just so illegitimate, it's frustrating. And I don't even want to talk about it. I don't like to converse with conspiracy theorists because it's so ridiculous that you're not going to be able to win the argument. There's always going to be something they can just pull out of the blue to hit you with. But think of all the players that would have to be on it, all the league officials, all the owners who are billionaires in their own right. And going back to the players, we've seen it before in different sports. The Black Sox scandal comes to mind. The NBA itself had an issue with it back in the early 2000s, that Kings-Lakers series, which I think goes down easily as one of the most questionable moments when it's come to NBA officiating we've ever seen. But just think of all the people that would have to be in on it, the risk it would take with all the billions and millions that the league are pulling in anyway. I just don't think it's likely. So with that, we'll throw that question in the trash. We move on to the Ichiro hit record. Greg Code of the Miami Herald had a great piece on that. Ichiro Suzuki is now the quote-unquote unofficial hits king of baseball. Between 1,278 hits with Oryx in Japan and 2,979 in the States between the Seattle Mariners, New York Yankees, and now the Miami Marlins, 16 years of Major League Baseball have now brought Ichiro Suzuki to a combined total of 4,257 hits, passing the non-Hall of Famer for reasons I think you know, Pete Rose, for the most hits in MLB history. Now, of course, the record isn't official. All of those hits weren't received in the MLB, but I think the biggest question we've come across over this past week is this a legitimate achievement? And I wrote about this a couple years back for the Tucson Citizen as a featured columnist back when that paper was around in Arizona. When Ichiro got his 3,000th hit with the Yankees, the big question emerged back then too, is this a legitimate achievement? And I'll be the first to admit, the competition in Japan isn't nearly anywhere close to the competition you see in Major League Baseball, but that brings off the side point. And Greg Coate wrote about this in the Miami Herald this week. Pete Rose has cast himself once again in a familiar role as a cantankerous and bitter, playing angry old man and begrudging the Marlins Ichiro Suzuki of his milestone accomplishment. I sort of get it. Rose, age 75, is only protecting what's his and what's left. The one major plank of his legacy that is untarnished and undisputed, he is the hit king. Nobody in the history of Major League Baseball has topped 4,256 hits, and it is a record that appears unassailable. When the game you love is ostracized you with a life sentence for gambling, when you're resigned to never being voted into the Hall of Fame that otherwise would have welcomed you as royalty, you hang on to what you can. The next thing you know, growls Rose in an interview about Ichiro this week, they'll be counting his high school hits. You know how athletes annoyingly like to say of an accomplishment, nobody can take it away from me, even though nobody's going to? That's sort of what's happening here. And I completely agree with Coates. No one in their right mind is saying that Ichiro has done in Major League Baseball over the length of a career what Pete Rose has done. What they're saying, and what I'm saying myself, is that throughout the course of a baseball career, Ichiro Suzuki has done more than Pete Rose has. And in fact, he hasn't done what Pete Rose has done. Be shrouded in controversy of gambling, get banned from the game for life in disgrace, and be left on the sidelines flapping his gums about how what Ichiro is doing is comparable to adding high school hits to your major league total. Which, of course, it isn't. And I think the biggest mark on Pete Rose's argument right now, as we look at the 20 greatest single-season hits that the league has ever seen, you go through these 20 names, some of them repeats. Ichiro Suzuki, Don Mattingly, Ed Delahanty, Willie Keeler, Rod Carew, Darren Erstand, Jesse Burkett, Wade Boggs, Haney Manush, Babe Herman, Ichiro Suzuki, George Sisler, Ty Cobb, Chuck Klein, Roger Hornsby, Al Simmons, Bill Terry, Lefty O'Doul, George Sisler, and the most hits ever in a single season, 262 by Ichiro Suzuki in 2004. Now, I'm not going to start a debate right now between Ichiro and Rose and who had the better career, because that's not the point of this. The point is that Rose is sitting here criticizing the accomplishment of a player who three times is mentioned in a list that Rose doesn't even appear in a single time. Looking at Ichiro's career numbers is just so much fun because they're so absurd. The first season he ever came here, he was MVP, hit 350, and then followed that up with 321, 312, 372, 303, 322, 351, 310, 352, 315, as he was an all-star every year for the first 10 years of his career here after coming over at 27 years old. It's been an absolute masterful career from Ichiro, and it's not done yet. He's hitting 350 through 55 games with Miami, which is just absurd at 42 years old. Ichiro is one of the greatest legends the game has ever seen, both with how he's carried himself on and off the field. And the fact that Rose is just going to sit there and bash that, while he himself may never make the Hall of Fame, that Ichiro is going to walk into without a question one day, is just tough to fathom. And I think Pete Rose is one of the big losers across the sports landscape this week. And I've backed him up. I think he should be in the Hall of Fame. I think his on-field achievements should be honored in some way by baseball, because what he truly did that got him banned was an off-the-field thing, something that was just unacceptable and had to be hammered down hard, the gambling that he committed both as a player and manager, they now say, between multiple reports. That's Pete Rose, that's Ichiro, and we move on to the last story of this Bobcast, June 17th. NFL marijuana controversy with Eugene Monroe. And this is from a story in the Huffington Post by Justin Block. The brutality of football lends itself two main things: a masculine pride among players for their toughness, and inevitable debilitating physical and mental injuries. Another issue, however, has been pushed to the forefront by active and retired NFL players, but it's also affected Americans outside of football. Painkiller or opioid addiction, more notoriously. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services issued an opioid overdose epidemic public health alert in 2014, but in football circles, trainers and doctors still give their injured players potentially addicting painkillers. NFL offensive lineman Eugene Monroe, whose contract was terminated on Wednesday by the Baltimore Ravens, has openly decried football's painkiller crisis and instead advocates for non-addictive cannabinoids or marijuana. While recovering from a January shoulder surgery, Monroe wrote a personal essay about using marijuana versus opioids, donated 80,000 medical marijuana researchers at Johns Hopkins University and the University of Pennsylvania, started his own website to centralize his efforts, and influenced the NFL enough to have its top doctors speak to the aforementioned researchers to learn about their work. All of this done in one single offseason. The Ravens weren't impressed, though, and their apparent discomfort with Monroe's pro-marijuana stance has led him to ponder whether his advocacy had anything to do with his release. Now, ESPN came out this week and pointed out the football reasons for Eugene Monroe's release between his contract, production, and injury history, but I think in this space, you have a legitimate conspiracy theory. The NFL has been adverse to change. They've had a hardline stance against marijuana for years, most notably seen with the Cleveland Browns and some of the suspension issues they've faced throughout the past few years, and some other players themselves too. But the NFL has, without getting too political, been against change. It was seen in the movie Concussion and the documentary League of Denial that they vehemently pushed against the efforts by former players to be compensated for the immense brain damage they took throughout their NFL careers. So that's now out there. If you're entering the NFL, you're going to be exposing yourself to injury. But I think a situation like this, where Eugene Monroe is pushing his own views out there and touching on an issue that's very human. This isn't a football issue. Of course, it's very relevant in the football world, but across the United States, people are dying daily from the opioid crisis. It's a disaster here in Massachusetts, and opioids, they are something else. It's scary stuff how those can just take over, consume, change who you are, and then take your life in the most embarrassing way possible. And the fact that the NFL is still pushing these on their players is very scary, and it continues to raise some of the concerns that we've had with the NFL over the past few years. Not only with the decline of on-field play, which I think many of us have seen, but these off-the-field issues, they're becoming hard to ignore with the NFL. And I'm not accusing the Baltimore Ravens of releasing Monroe because of his views on marijuana, which I won't support one way or the other. But if they did cut Monroe because of his efforts to attack opioids with an alternative in marijuana, shame on them. I mean, that's their right. You don't have to hold a player because of what he's saying and support his views. And in fact, that's not protected by the First Amendment either. If you do not like what your employees are saying, you have the right to let them go. But, man, it is not a good look for the NFL, which has just been shrouded in controversy between opioids, domestic abuse, brain damage. It's a very sad thing to see, and hopefully the NFL is going to start becoming open to change, because right now their resistance against their fans, against their players, it's just becoming frustrating to watch, even as a fan. So, before we go, I want to give a shout-out to Chance the Rapper. The Recording Academy, who runs the Grammy Awards, is now opening the doors to mixtapes, streaming-only albums. They're opening their doors to the internet, pretty much, and it's largely because of the efforts Chance has made over the past few years, and especially with this last album, Coloring Book, which is an absolute hit, I must say. You have to listen to that album if you've not heard it. Chance almost single-handedly has opened the Grammys to change, and this year, in February, Coloring Book will all but likely be up for a Grammy because Chance himself has opened the door to the internet. Now, independent artists, mixtapes, all these different platforms of music that we see now in the 21st century are going to have their shot at winning music's most prestigious award. And you got to give Chance all the credit in the world for that. We'll touch more on that in our fifth episode of the Bobcast when Mel Smith of UMG joins us. But for now, that's been the second episode of the Bobcast. Thanks for Snotty Drippin' for joining us. Thanks to everyone who tuned in for our first two episodes. It's been a fantastic ride, and we're going to keep on rolling the Bobcast, a weekly tour of sports and pop culture. Follow us at The Bobcast Show, and you can follow me, Bobby Manning, at Real Bob Manning on Twitter. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week with a guest I'm very excited about. CoverThoseBases.com, baseball extraordinaire Devin Fink is joining us. Thank you for hopping aboard the weekly tour. We'll see you next week.